This is the Mason Vera Payne Show, your go-to lifestyle program, covering everything from technology and gaming to movies, TV shows, and pop culture to the supernatural and beyond. Brought to you by WGNRadio.com with your host, the unabridged millennial, Mason Vera Payne.
Mason Vera Payne here, live from the MVP Studios in Chicago, and thank you for tuning in. There may be a way to stop terrorist attacks. This is according to the director of the Lakai Foundation, Gwen Griffith-Dixon. She joins to explain what makes people carry out these attacks and how we as citizens can potentially prevent a future attack. Thanks for joining me, Gwen.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Could you tell me, how did your foundation start? What got you into this?
I was working in a university. I was working with lots of different faith groups and community groups. And I just got impatient being in what could be an ivory tower. Actually, the programs I ran were pretty community-focused and real-world-focused, but I just wanted to somehow bring the depth of thinking and of thinking with different communities, different backgrounds, together with making some kind of real change in the world. So I decided just to take a big step and leave the university world, more or less, and start a foundation that would bring all kinds of different people, different backgrounds, different opinions together and see what we could create.
What are some of the projects that you've been working at?
And a lot of the stuff that we have done, we got dragged kind of almost against our will in a way into a lot of the counter-terrorist stuff because it happened after 9/11 and we started it just before the kind of English version of that in July 2005 where four terrorists targeted the London subway and bus system. So because we had really good relationships all around with police and government and Muslim communities, we kind of got pulled in from both sides as needing someone who could be trusted to address those issues. So we set up the kind of first big program across the country for so-called de-radicalizing people, dealing with people who are going down that road and needed to be brought back. We've prevented a terrorist attack ourselves. We could have worked on a big program bringing together police and Muslim communities to kind of build trust and get over the suspicion. But we also have kind of done things like comedy shows on campus, skills training to skill up young people for leadership, particularly in conflict situations. So we kind of have a range of things with the different faiths. But a lot of it we've got pulled into less of the stuff I'd like to do, not so much the feel-good, warm glow stuff, but the really hard end just because someone's got to do it, I suppose.
So before Lakai Foundation was formed, was there any counter-terrorism units within government agencies, or this kind of spurred it?
They had, because there was a Northern Ireland experience, England and the United Kingdom were pretty experienced in the whole terrorist thing. So they'd had decades of dealing with bombs going off and buildings being blown up and people in London just having to be aware that things could happen at any time and living with that kind of awareness. So it was less new to the government in some ways, but it was still very much an investigative, pursue criminal type approach, which is important. But one of the things that I think has been recognized that they really need is to work much earlier and in a more positive way. So that's, in a sense, has been our platform, is seeing the potential of all of us to prevent violence and take a kind of a broad view of what actually counts as violence against people, because victimizing minorities, for example, is not a, you know, by the majority groups in any given society is also, it can be a form of terrorism, but it certainly is a form of social and political violence that puts us all at risk.
What do you think communities could do to help prevent terrorists from joining terrorist groups in an early stage? What do you think could be done?
Well, a lot of it actually happens, not the way I think people think. People imagine, you know, either that they're evil already, or this religion is already evil, and that people get brainwashed into it. Actually, what happens, and we're seeing it more and more with Islamic State, so-called Islamic State, is that people are already vulnerable. It's like who comes down with pneumonia? You know, you're already in some ways, there's some kind of vulnerability there. And the way that people are vulnerable is because some key need in their life isn't being met. Now, that could be a need for meaning, a need for belief, a need to make an impact on the world, a need for respect from other people. Of course, there's like financial needs, for example. So if someone is already got stuff going on in their lives that's not helping them to lead a really positive, fulfilling existence, then they're going to be more likely to get targeted by a recruiter who can play on that and manipulate them. So look, the people around you don't trust you. You're treated like a suspect. Look at these terrible things that are being done to Muslims all around the world, and you're a part of that, and you can't trust them. If that rings true with their experience, then it's going to be so much more easy to recruit them into joining a violent group. So what we can all do is actually look after each other better and build a better sense of community where we don't let people become so vulnerable that they're targeted. We make sure that young people can be have a sense of meaning and value in their lives. They can actually make an impact and contribute something to society rather than, you know, treating young people as a threat or a nuisance or as unimportant. So in a sense, what we need to do is the general conditions for a flourishing life that a community would have anyway, give people a sense of meaning and purpose, jobs and meaningful work to do, sense of belonging to each other and caring for each other, which would do so much for everybody. It's not just singling out a particular group. That's also what we need to do to prevent people being attracted to violence.
Yeah, that's true. A sense of community can really keep a person grounded. But what happens if they don't have that? And I know for a lot of people, especially the younger generation, they tend to use social media as a way of forming a community. Do you think social media should be playing a bigger part in preventing people from being victimized by joining these terrorist groups?
Yes, I do think that. And a lot of it has focused, I think a lot of it happens because governments find it an easy target. Oh, it's all social media's fault. You know, Google, Facebook, YouTube should be doing more. Twitter should be doing more. And that's a kind of easy target for politicians that are on the defensive. It is true that they should be doing more, but that's still focusing on taking stuff down, banning stuff, removing content, banning users. And I think that's still too negative a way to look at it. We can look more positively on what people can do through social media to reach out, because actually that's what Islamic State does really skillfully. I'm not saying that in a happy way. Obviously, I think it's a bad thing that they're doing a good job. But what I mean is that they will find particular individuals and they will like message them 20 times a day, maybe, through social media, through Twitter. And they're getting this kind of individualized attention and manipulation is what it really is. But a lot of us are starving for attention and being taken seriously and having some sense of contact and belonging, and it's being supplied through that route. So if we can find more positive ways to give people positive regard and positive attention through using social media, that was a really brilliant thing that we could be doing.
Do you think that news outlets kind of sensationalize or even, dare I say, romanticize terrorism?
They do. I think they do. I think they do. There's a number of roles that they play which aren't helpful. And one thing is, I think the different ways that they treat different kinds of attacks, and if it's by someone that's different from the background of the majority of your listeners, then it's more likely to be a terrorist attack. If it's by someone from your own background, it's someone who's mentally ill. It was really interesting. Some people were commenting here in England. We had the terrorist attack on London Bridge, where some Muslims drew a van into pedestrians and then jumped out to stab people. And then a very short time later, we had a white guy driving a van through. This one happened in my own neighborhood. And they drove through a crowd of Muslim people coming out of the mosque and jumped out. They were apprehended, so they didn't succeed in stabbing people. But people talked about Muslims driving a van, and then the headline in the paper was, vehicle drives on the pavement and kills, you know, it's like the vehicle is the terrorist, right?
Right.
They don't actually say white man terrorist, you know, in a terrorist attack. So even if it's unconscious, the language changes. So I think the media tends to portray white supremacist or right-wing or Dylan Roof type situations, or the terrible thing that happened in Portland where three white men stood up to protect and defend some Muslim young women and got stabbed. Two of them died. Those situations, they're less likely to name as terrorist and more likely to single out the groups that are different. And that, I think, just heightens everyone's fear and everyone's suspicions about these scary people who are threatening us, whereas the statistic, the latest study shows that in the United States, there are twice as many terrorist attacks carried out by the far-right, white supremacist-style people and than there are Muslim attacks. So you're twice as more likely to be injured or killed or attacked by, you know, if you're white, people who look like you, than you are by Muslim terrorists. And all of that tends to get amplified, I think, by the media.
What do you think can be done, like in the U.S., the U.K., where we as communities can do something to stop this? Because, you know, if we rely on the news and big corporations, it takes a long time.
It does. And we also can't forget that they're driven by the economics of it, right? I mean, you're, I'm sure, a noble exception, but, of course, a lot of the news networks, they're there to make money. They're
right.
Not, you know, necessarily there for public service. And they probably know really, really well what their customers, as it were, what they want to see and what will make them switch on, switch off, what will make them stay on after the ad break. So they probably have it down to an art. So to some extent, I think the long-term answer is we need to change our behavior and what we'll accept and endorse from them. Short-term, I think some of the tactics, like even, say, Twitter, the kind of derision and making fun of media networks for their stupid headlines or for their approach, I think that does get through. They do start to notice that. And, of course, if you want to be more activist, there's the boycott thing. I mean, we've seen that with Fox recently and who's kind of lost their job or whose show has been taken down when it's been brought. The advertisers think, well, actually, I don't think I want to be on that program because of what he said. So we've seen, I think, a few cases where if you want to be activist and really protest about something that you just think is wrong, you know, mounting a, you know, threatening the companies or saying, look, we're going to boycott your product if you're supporting this kind of aggressive, hate-making approach. That, you know, at the end of the day, I think money is the one thing that really will persuade some of the corporate broadcasters.
What about if you don't want to, like, because I know personally, I'm not trying to throw myself into, like, a protest type of situation. Mm. So if I wanted to do something more low-key, and I know the boycotting the channel, but that seems so small. Is there something like, you know, should I be going to, like, community events or should I be starting one?
Yeah, exactly. I think some of the really effective things are the things that look really gentle and they can be mocked by people, but they're actually really high impact in a quiet way that we don't always appreciate. Having a dinner, having a street party in your neighborhood, inviting people, getting to know people, because the really biggest impact thing we can do is to start building friendships across the groups where we have distrust and we're hostile. So holding a little local event where you ask different people to share their point of view in an atmosphere where you say, okay, we're not going to attack each other for our views, let's just hear and understand. If you don't get it, then ask questions about it and have just like really relaxed, informal social gatherings. Visit people's community centers, their religious groups. But it's not always even, it doesn't have to be that religious-based, because we talk a lot about interfaith dialogue, and I really believe in that, but it doesn't have to be religion-y all the time. It's just people from, like, a different culture, different background. Some of it may be skin color, some of it may be religion, some may be where they come from. But it's just that, you know, we just tend to kind of avoid people that aren't like us. So anything we can do to break down that kind of unconscious reaction and just get to know each other actually makes a huge difference. And you don't have to be political. You can be anywhere on the political spectrum, but as long as you don't believe in killing each other and you want to make all of us safer and build that sense of community, I think the kind of some of the feel-good stuff actually is really high impact, and it's not a soft option. It really is. That's what we've learned. It's not a soft option. It's actually really effective.
Well, thank you so much, Gwen, for coming on. I really appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much, Mason. Really lovely to talk to you and hear from you.
For more information and learning about the Lakai Foundation, visit lakai.org.uk. That's lokahi.org.uk.
This has been the Mason Vera Payne Show. Thanks for listening. Can't wait to hear more? Subscribe, rate, and comment at masonverapaine.com. That's masonverapaine.com. Also, follow Mason on Facebook and Twitter at Mason Vera Payne. That's all one word. And don't forget to share the show with your friends.